Welcome to the Religious Studies Project, hosted by Christopher Cotter and myself, David Robertson. This podcast is produced in association with the British Association for the Study of Religions, and you can visit our website at www.religiousstudiesproject.com. So I'm joined today by Professor Eileen Barker, who is probably, definitely one of the foremost experts on what we would term in the sociology of religion, new religious movements. And what we're going to be talking about today is the classic study of new religious movements from sort of 1960s onwards right up to the present day. So really how scholars go about studying new religious movements and what new religious movements are. For the benefit of the public, and maybe people who don't quite know what I mean when I'm saying new religious movement, what is a new religious movement?
Well, that's a big question that we haven't quite solved yet, and lots of people think of different things. And of course, as far as scientists are concerned, concepts are more or less useful, not more or less true. And we found different ways of defining it useful, as indeed one does with religion. It started off as being either a cult or a sect, using the old Trolsch-Niebuhr categorization. That is a newish, usually, movement that was in tension with society, the kind of groups that Brian Wilson, for example, wrote about. But first of all, as Wilson himself said, this was very much focused on Christocentric religions and didn't really fit with some of the new religions. And secondly, it started, both cult and sect in the French language, to have very negative connotations. Mm. And if you called somebody a cult, then that told the audience more about yourself, that you didn't like them, than it told the audience about what the group movement thought. So we started in the 1970s using the term new religious movement. The Japanese had actually used that as well. But then there were problems because we were including sort of Jehovah's Witnesses or immigrant groups that were new to a particular country but could have been around for decades or centuries, millennia even. And were they religious? Well, some groups like the Raelians, which is a UFO cult, calls itself an atheistic religion. Mm. A lot of the groups don't want to be called a religion. Transcendental meditation has fought in the courts not to be called a religion so that it can teach in schools, for example.
Yeah, because in the US, yes.
Because of the United States First Amendment to the Constitution. And at the same time, Scientology, which lots of people would think was less obviously a religion, has fought to be defined so that it can get charitable status. Yeah. So there are a lot of secular consequences, quite apart from academic consequences. Gordon Melton and I had a sort of disagreement because he is a historian and also theologically trained. He's a Methodist minister, and he said that the movements had more in common with the tradition from which they came than with each other. And I, as a sociologist, would agree with Gordon to a large extent that these are important to look at the traditions. But I did think that there were certain things that followed from newness. Hmm. So what I have tended to do is to talk about new religious movements as first generation. That is, as movements which are predominantly filled with converts. And I think a lot of things follow from that. And also, paradoxically, it allows you to look at second generation and how they age because you're starting from the beginnings. Now, there are difficulties. I mean, some go on having converts, but then you can say that because at least it's clear. Whereas if you just say in tension with society or some of the other suggestions that have been put forward for defining new religious movement, like saying the time of the cutoff, I think you get into a lot of a muddle. But that's just my thing that I find useful.
Just on the way up to this interview, I was speaking to someone else saying that I was going to be speaking with Eileen Barker, and I said I might, rhetorically throw the word the word cult out there and see what happened. And my friend said, yeah, that he still teaches students who are your third, fourth year of an undergraduate degree, who still throw the term cult around in a quite pejorative way without really understanding what they're saying. Could you say a bit more about that term cult as it is used in the public? And well, we know it's used pejoratively,
yes, it is. I've just been in Israel, for example, and there they've just the government has produced a report on what to do about cults. They haven't really defined cults. It's quite obvious that they mean nasty, bad groups, and they want to introduce a special law to deal with cults. The French have introduced a special law to deal with sects, so have the Russians, and the Chinese, of course, dealing with the evil cults. And it's a label that you put on a group to indicate that it's a bad group. I mean, there's nothing that follows necessarily, or there are various things where it can follow, and then there's a technical term that was introduced by Tolch, as compared to sect and church and denomination. I think the important thing is that you've got to be clear what you mean, so that you can define the group as an independent variable and not say, because it's a cult, it brainwashes, they all commit mass suicide, there's child abuse, financial skullduggery, political intrigue, etc., etc., all being lumped together, insinuated in the name. But to have something which is independent, like my suggestion of first generation converts as membership, and then see whether a particular group which has first generation membership does brainwash, whatever that means, does commit child abuse. Because the problem is, if you just sort of generalise with the word cult, what do you do about Catholic priests who commit child abuse? Does that mean that they're a cult? Well, the Russian Orthodox Church says that the Catholics are a cult, but that's because they're not Russian Orthodox Church. So it's a very messy, unclear, and I think obfuscating. When people want to condemn by using cult, very often they hide what is going on, because just by giving this generalising label, you're not really finding out what is going on. And of course, some groups do carry out child abuse, some groups do engage in financial skullduggery, etc. But not all of them do, but some do some of the time, and some do some of the time harm to some of the people. But you've got to look at the particulars, and you can't do that if you've just got a messy, negative label. You don't know what really you're talking about. I think you're going to ask me later about INFORM, which is the organisation that I set up in the 80s to study new religions. And this is highly controversial, because there are other groups that study them, and in Britain particularly. But what the government and the police have said to us is that the anti-cult groups, it's no point in their asking the anti-cult groups what a particular movement is like, because they know already what they'll say.
Yeah.
Because they'll say, oh, it's a cult, and that means all these things. Whereas if they come to INFORM, they will be told what they believe and what they do. And so I think it's very important to be clear what it is you're talking about. But it isn't more or less true that something's a cult. To repeat, it's more or less useful, rather like Weber's ideal type.
Yeah, and I think I actually saw you had a piece in The Guardian a few years ago about I just read it on the train on the way down, so about it was one person's cult is another person's true religion, I think was the title. And actually saw someone's comment, because online, of course, people comment on things, and you know, they were like, well, all religions are cults, aren't they?
Yes.
That's become quite a prevalent...
Well, of course, in France, the term cult is used for Catholicism in the mainstream, and they use sect, or what do they have, sectarian derive, which can't be translated or is translated in a whole lot of ways, for the baddies. But yeah. cult is the goodies.
Yeah. So, since you mentioned Inform there, we might as well talk a little bit more about it. Can you just tell us about what Inform is, what it seeks to do, and then I guess what Inform has been doing for 25 years?
1988.
Yeah.
It actually opened shop on the 1st of January. Yes, Inform stands for Information Network Focus on Religious Movements. And it was in the 1980s. I'd been studying the new religious movements for some time, and it seemed to me that there was a lot of unnecessary suffering through both ignorance and misinformation about the movements. The misinformation was coming from the movements and from their opponents and from the media. And so people were carrying out actions like deprogramming people, kidnapping them and holding them until they renounced their faith or managed to escape. Or you could get the state level, things like Waco and the FBI stormed into the Branch Davidians compound and succeeded in killing the children that they were going to rescue, which was quite unnecessary, as the FBI themselves appreciated. They've done very well in recognizing this and trying to change in the future. But these things have happened, and so it seemed to me necessary to make available the work of social scientists, let me put it this way, social scientists aren't renowned for their exciting, sexy writings. And a lot of very good work, PhDs and other work, was just ending up in
dusty library
shelves. So it seemed important to be able to offer this information to the general public. So what Inform aims to do is to provide, to help people by providing information that's as accurate, reliable, objective as possible about minority religions. And we get inquiries from all over the world. First of all, it was mainly concerned parents. They were the largest minority, and now it's more governments, including the police, law enforcement agencies, but we also have students, the media, various professionals, lawyers, doctors, counsellors, academics, all sorts of people can come to us and we try and help them. And an important thing about the name is it's Information Network. And we can't do all the research ourselves, though we do some. But we try and put people in touch. We have this great big network all over the world of specialists, not only academics, but primarily academics, perhaps. But we would also include the new religions themselves and their opponents. There are some anti-cult groups, as they're called, that we have quite good relations with. Others won't speak to us and just try and destroy us. But anybody, and the media, of course, anybody who has information, we try and collect it from them and we'll listen to them. And our inquirers, of course, give us quite a lot of information. So we collect information from anywhere. Then we have to sort it all out. And, of course, we have to assess it. And very often we can't reach a definite conclusion about who's right because there are so many different perspectives on the groups, in which case we will say we get this impression or there's this perspective from the group itself, whereas parents tell us other things. So we have to be clear about this. We don't just provide a nice, neat little picture always, almost seldom. And then we disseminate. And we disseminate by responding to the inquiries. We get between one and two on average every working day. And sometimes we can just answer on a quick telephone, but sometimes we have to write reports that can take weeks or longer. So we do that. That's the sort of primary thing. But we also have seminars twice a year, day-long seminars on particular subjects like new religions and the media, new religions and children, new religions and gender, new religion. Well, the next one's going to be on prophecy.
Yeah.
New religions and the media, I've said that, new religions and the law. We've done nearly 50 of these now.
Wow.
And then we've also had big international conferences. Oh, I should go back to the seminars. What we do there is we invite different people to give 20-minute talks.
Mm.
And we invite members, former members, anti-cultists, professionals who have some particular interest, and academics. So we get a very wide range of perspectives. And the audience, there's usually about 100 people who come.
Yeah.
They come from all different forms with different interests, and it's almost unique in that this is a situation in which people who disagree with each other violently listen to each other and then exchange. We have small group discussions as well, and quite a good breaks for coffee and tea and lunch, and so they do their own disseminating of their own perspectives.
Yeah.
And then we have these large normal conferences where academics and people offer papers, and those are international, and we can get 300 or 400 people for those. And then we have closed workshops. The seminars and conferences are open to anybody, but the closed workshops are for specialists like clergy, the police. We've given one in Scotland Yard, welfare people, social workers. For example, we've been doing stuff on the child witches, and various other interested groups have asked us to inform them. Various government departments, we've given closed things. And also, we've invited the organisations, the cult-watching organisations in France and Belgium, which have a very different perspective from Inform. And to do them credit, they have come, and we've had interesting days with them. And we've invited somebody from the government and the police to sort of try and show the different perspective that British have on what to do about the cults. And actually, we also did something which was unique. We had four, quote, cult-watching groups, Belgium, Switzerland, Canada, and Inform. And I invited four members of, quote, cults. We had a couple of people from the Moonies, Unification Church, Hare Krishna, the Children of God, now the Family International, and the Jesus Army. And it took a long time to persuade them all to come, and we spent a day together, and we discussed something that I'm particularly interested in at the moment, which is aging.
Okay.
Because this is a potential problem. It's becoming a problem because people who joined the well-known movements, particularly those whom I invited, in the 70s, young people, enthusiastic, gave up their careers or their educational studies, worked for long hours for nothing, no pensions, no medical insurance or anything, and now they're coming up to retirement age, and they don't know what's going to happen. Some movements have arranged things, but others haven't. Some have got no money, others have got money, but the leaders are keeping the money.
Yep.
And so this really is something that to me is very interesting. And we discussed that. And then since then, the other three cult-watching groups have been arranging similar things. So we started that off, which is quite interesting. And then just to continue about the dissemination, we have leaflets. We've got a website, which we want to put a whole lot more on. We've also produced several books. Mm. I wrote something for the Home Office just as I set up Inform, called New Religions, New Religious Movements, A Practical Introduction. And we've published papers from some of our conferences, and we've now got a series with Ashgate where we're doing edited volumes from the seminars where we have all these different people. We've already got one out on the child witches. The next one coming out is on intentional communities. We've got one coming out on prophecy, one on revisionism in the new religions, one on African new religions, one on Islamic new religions. Anyway, you get the idea. So, and in these, we have academics, but we also have practitioners and enemies, opponents. So they're unlike normal academic books, but they include some of the data, as it were. What else do we do? Well, that gives you a sort of idea of what we do.
I mean, that sounds brilliant, to be honest, because one of the things that academics do is that we tend to get very abstracted from the real world and from the actual people that we study. One thing which is always buzzing around in my head when I hear about, I'll call this engaged scholarship, it is objectivity. And I'm sure you're very conscious the whole time about retaining some sense of, well, should you retain some sense of objectivity? That's a whole discussion that we could have. But yeah, well, how do you negotiate this very engaged form of scholarship where you're inviting practitioners along, you're providing information for governments and police and distressed parents and things. So how do you negotiate that whilst keeping an academic rigour? And we could relate this to any scholar studying new religious movements.
Well, all the staff have at least a master's degree in social sciences and methodology. Three have got PhDs, and it is very much based on the methods of social science. So it involves empirical work, obviously, and also some of the logic of social science, the methodology, the comparative method. An example I often give is that one sees a headline saying cultists commit suicide. And you might see that two or three times in a month and you think, oh dear, what is it about cults that makes them commit suicide? I mean, it's perfectly true. Some of them do. But of course you don't see a headline saying Anglican or Catholic commit suicide. It's unlikely to be mentioned at all. It's just not sexy. Yeah. And so, of course, social science methodology wouldn't just say, what is it about cults that makes people commit suicide? It would look at the rate of suicide in the movement and the rate of suicide in the general population with a similar age and background. And it might be that that's twice as great as the suicide rate in the movement. So then the question is perhaps, what is it that stops people committing suicide in the movement? Of course, it's a bit more complicated than that, but that just sort of indicates one of the things. Another thing is that, well, it's the same sort of question, but visibility is not the same as typicality. And so that's one very important thing that I think just logic of social science and the importance of the methodologic. And there are a whole lot of other ways. We can't always know, as I said earlier. Sometimes we just have to say, well, there are very different views. And the people that we're talking to will be interested in different questions. So another example I often give is that although one tries to be objective, we do select out what we think will be of use to the person who's asking us the question. So if we know that a group commits sacrifices virgins on the altar, we're more likely to tell the inquirer about that than we are to tell them what they normally have for breakfast. You know, you can't give the whole truth. So we do select certain things, but we're very keen not to tell people what to do. We can't, because social science can't say what a cult is. We're always asked, is this a cult or a religion? We have to say, well, what do you mean by a cult? What do you mean by a religion? We can't say whether the theology is true or false. We can't use God as an independent variable. We can say Johnny believes he joined because God spoke to him, but Johnny's mum thinks it was Satan. But we can't say which it was. We have to be methodologically agnostic, which, of course, is not the same as methodologically atheist. I've lost my thought. One thing I might mention is that not so much now, but certainly when we began, we had a lot of strange phone calls. And very often these were from the new religions, and they'd phone up and say, oh, my son's joined such and such a cult. Can you tell me about it? And it was actually the movement itself asking us, or it was the anti-cultists. So we always know that we're likely to be tripped up. There are people out there who really don't like us very much. And although this can be a nuisance, it's actually a very good thing, because we've got to be able to justify what we say. And so we're always very careful when we write the leaflets. The public version of them don't have streams of references, but we have those. Sort of hidden comments, so that we can defend ourselves if we are asked. So it's sort of best practice according to the methods of social science. And this is really what we have to do. And where social science can't help us, we just say, I'm sorry, we can't tell you. But we think we can be more accurate than either the movements themselves, who select only the good things and don't talk about skeletons in the cupboard, or their opponents, who select only the bad things or what they consider theologically wrong. Or the media, who select only the sexy and the novel and the exciting and the sensational and don't tell you the ordinary things, and certainly don't do any sort of comparative analysis. Or a whole lot of other people who have got vested interests. We try to make it as balanced as possible. But of course we can never be completely balanced, but we just have to be aware when we're not being.
So it's really illustrative of what any scholar of religion needs to be doing, well, of any social phenomenon needs to be doing the whole time.
Absolutely.
I certainly know that I'm very interested in new religious movements, and I think it's probably because of the sexy, exciting stuff. You know, it's more interesting than studying Catholicism again. You know, it's something a bit more interesting.
You said it.
So I'm wondering, scholars who get involved in this field, in this sort of subfield of the wider study of religion, aside from whether they get involved because it's sexy or not, what does studying new religious movements have to offer the wider study of religion? Like, is there something about seeing a movement at a very early stage that really, you know, contributes to the wider theoretical?
You know, a lot of things. I think I'm sort of driven by vulgar curiosity. I'm just amazed that people can believe and do some of the things that they believe and do that I never would, and I find it a big challenge to try and understand. And usually after some time one does begin to have an understanding that if you suspend certain beliefs or you take on certain assumptions, then it makes kind of sense. Not always, but that's the challenge, to try and see why people do it. It's the general thing about sociology of religion. Who believes what, under what circumstances, and what are the consequences? The new religions, in some way, particularly when they're new, are smaller and therefore, in one sense, easier to understand, because they tend to be more black and white, and they know what they're doing, or at least they think they do. The sort of sharp boundaries and divisions, and you can get at what they're at a bit more than you can if you try and understand what Anglicanism is up to.
Mm.
But there are other difficulties, of course, sometimes just access. I think you need triangulation at least for studying it, but I think this is general, but certainly in my own studies I have used in-depth interview, and by in-depth I mean up to 12 hours.
Wow.
I've used participant observation, living with the groups and watching them. You get a very different perspective from the interview. And very often when I'm interviewing and staying, I see somebody and understand, I think, what they're like through this in-depth interview, and then I look at them in the social context and you get a very, very different picture. And then, of course, when you're doing the participant observation, you can see things like communication networks and social structures and things which you'd never get from the interview. On the other hand, from the interview, you've got some idea of how it all works and what's going on. And then I think you also need questionnaire in order to be able to generalise. And you need a control group in order to be able to see what's typical and what's atypical. So sometimes, I mean, at the beginning of when I was studying the Unification Church, I kept coming across, in Britain, people who tended to be alcoholic, and in America tended to be taking drugs. And actually, that was just sort of normal for the two cultures, and nothing really to do with it being unification. Similarly, I found quite a few people that had been abused as children, but when I checked with the control group, it was no more than their generation.
Yeah.
So the control group really is very important, and I'm afraid a lot of the studies of new religious movements haven't included control groups. And then, of course, you have to look at the literature, their literature, and all the stuff that's written against them or about them. You can't take a new religious movement in isolation. Even those that are what Roy Wallace called world-rejecting cut themselves off. They are dependent on the society to get, money and food, and defence, but also new recruits. And they've usually got parents or somebody battering against them. They are part of society, so you have to understand the relationships with all these different sections in society. And then nowadays, of course, there's the web. And there are new religious movements on the web that are up virtual new religious movements, and they're growing, and I mean some of them are quite fun. And then there's sort of growth in, there are all sorts of funny names that are given to them, not only the virtual new religions but sort of pseudo new religions. There's the I can't remember the terms that are used by people who are studying things like the Jedi Knights. There's the Monster Spaghetti.
Yeah, the Church of the Flying Spaghetti Monster.
That's right, the Pastafarians. The Moo Church. Lots of the Matrix have got kind of followers.
Yeah.
All these inventive new religions, term that Carol Cusack uses. And there's another one that Titus Helm uses that I've just done something for his book on that, and I can't remember what the term, hyper-religions.
Okay.
Anyway, there are all these sort of variations that I think one has to look at, and be careful about making generalisations, because you can't generalise about what they want, what they're like. Of course, being a sociologist, I do generalise, but you've always got to realise. I used to tell my students every year, if they could come up with one variable apart from the fact that they've been called a cult or a new religious movement, which all of them shared, I'd give them a box of Smarties. But I never had to give away that box of Smarties. You can always find some sort of counter fact.
Yeah. I'm just going to have two final questions.
Mm-hmm.
You alluded in an article, which I read a couple of days ago, that in some cultures it may not be considered advisable academically to be pursuing studies of new religious movements. Mm. I wonder if you could elaborate on that.
Yeah, it's certainly not always a good career move. That's not really been the case in Britain, although I have had people write to the director at London School of Economics saying that I was an unfit person to teach my students because I associated with the cults. Luckily, the director just forwarded these letters with, here's a bit more data written on it. If people had taken seriously some of the things that had been said to me, I would have been in trouble. But in other countries, Germany, for example, I've heard several stories of people whose supervisors have advised them very strongly not to do this. One person in America who did an in-depth study of one of the movements and did participant observation, when he came up with his PhD, he was told that he had to make it absolutely clear that he disapproved of them and write in negative things, not because the examiners knew this, but he's been told that he couldn't expect to get an academic job otherwise. There is quite a suspicion that you can find, and as you move to Eastern Europe, it can become very dangerous for your career to study the movements. It's, you can be treated with a lot of suspicion, and sometimes that suspicion can lead to really stymieing your career.
Mm. We don't want to close on that depressing note, because we're wanting to encourage people. If someone's out there, if a student's out there thinking about, you know, getting into this material, apart from the Inform website, where should they be looking for information? And where would you, do you have any areas you'd like to see researched in future, a direction you would like it to be going?
Well, it's two different questions. Where should they be looking? I certainly think they should look at the movements themselves. There's quite a lot of stuff coming out, which is second, third, fourth, fifth hand, where there's a lot of rubbish written. So I think, you know, they've got to look. Some of the movements are very difficult to access. What sort of things? Well, there are new movements coming up the whole time, and as you just suggested, there's the invented, there's the fictional, there's all the web stuff. Just what they find interesting.
Yeah.
I mean, some people will be turned on by one, some by another, and I don't want to tell anybody what they. If you're not interested, don't just do it because that's where you can get a grant or because some old lady like me has said, do that. Do what you find fascinating. It's so full of different things. I mean, I like the variety. Having done in-depth studies with about three or four, I've actually talked to, I should think, people from, I don't know, 400 or 500 different groups over the past 100 years, and they're all different, but there are certain patterns that you can see. So by all means, they should contact Inform, and we will try and help them, but it's up to them to find and choose, all because they're new. They are new, this stuff. You've got to be careful to some extent. I mean, you know, some of the movements are pretty nasty, and you don't want to be sacrificed on the altar.
No.
You need to take certain precautions because there isn't the accountability or the predictability that there is if you're going to study the Church of England. So it's as well to get what kind of advice you can, but you don't necessarily have to take it.
Yeah. Well, wonderful. Thanks so much for that, and you clearly find what you're doing fascinating, mm-hmm. and hopefully...
I keep hoping to stop, but I think I'll have to die first.
Yeah, hopefully people listening to this will find it fascinating too. So thank you very much.
You've just been listening to me speaking with Eileen Barker back at the Sockerel Conference in March 2012. Join us again next week, where Jonathan Tuckett does his first interview for the Religious Studies Project, speaking with Lisbeth Mikkelsen of the University of Bergen, on religion and gender. Remember to check out our website, religiousstudiesproject.com, and tune in again next week. Thanks for listening.